Coming up next from the grassy knoll, a terrifying look into the Orwellian world of brainwashing, disinformation, and ultimately control over
you.
Segment of the Grassy Knoll, and we have with us today anybody who's listened to the show for any amount of time will not have any difficulty remembering this particular individual, Dr. John Coleman, and amongst his works, one in particular also, and that is the Committee of 300. And he's with us today, and I guess kind of celebrating the fourth edition of the Committee of 300. And Dr. Coleman, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Keith.
Well, I'll tell you what. Would you mind going into, as in-depth as you wish, the history behind writing that, when the first edition came up, and whatever you want to bring up about the book and the personages and the events that are contained therein?
Well, the book is, I've just finished in January of this year, the fourth edition of the Committee of 300. It's a substantial work, 488 pages. And I began this work in 1969. We've had four editions of the book. This is the fourth and the most comprehensive version of the book. It's printed in many different languages. It's a big seller in Japan, in Russia, in England, strangely enough, of all places. We are negotiating with a Hollywood company now to make a movie of it. It's going to be made. The scriptwriter is busy, very busy writing the script, and I'm in almost daily contact with him about that. Of course, we'll be the consultant to the work. And so the book has received pretty good recognition. And I came across this organization in 1969, 65 onwards, from 65 to 69, when I saw some dispatches when I was working out in Angola in West Africa. It's an oil-rich, mineral-rich country. That's what actually started me on my investigation as to what this all is all about. There must be some controlling force, and of course, on that I got into the documents in them. I've had a very wonderful opportunity to study for 5 years at the British Museum in London, and I don't think there's anybody else in America on the so-called conservative right wing, which I am, of course, a conservative, has ever had this opportunity. And during the course of that 5-year study, I was given a great deal of access to documents which are not normally available to people. The British Museum is two museums. There's one closed to the public, and of course there's the open public. There's a public museum where everybody can go. I did all of my studies in the closed area of the museum. I had some wonderful mentors, and in consequence was able to gather a very great deal of knowledge on the subject. And added to that, I've lived in 14 different countries of the world and had hands-on contact with all of the people, or many of the people or organizations, or their descendants, their relatives and descendants mentioned in my book, so that I can claim to have a pretty comprehensive overview of what is, after all, a great conspiracy. We've now had that enunciated fairly recently by former President George Herbert Walker Bush, who claimed quite openly that the New World Order is coming. And of course, that's the ultimate aim of this organization, the New World Order inside a one world government, which will return the world to the feudal ages and the dark ages, and we will see a tyranny such as the world has never experienced before. And based upon what I saw and what I witnessed, and I studied this thing from every aspect. I was particularly interested in the way these people have set out to gather and garner all the raw material assets of the world, which they claim belong to them. Their chief spokesman, Lord Bertrand Russell, once said that the world is filled with useless eaters, people who are consuming the natural resources that belong to the Olympians. which is another name for the Committee of 300. And what I discovered when I went out to Hong Kong and to the Middle East and to Thailand was, of course, all about the extensive dealings of the British East India Company, which is the largest trading company in the world. And if you take General Motors and Ford combined, their turnover didn't even begin to come anywhere near the turnover of the British East India Company, which was based upon growing and selling opium to China. The opium was grown in the Benares and Ganges Valley in India, the best land, and they took samples of the poppies back to Kew Gardens in London and improvised the strain of poppy that would do well. And then the British, who were in control of India, were able to ship with the so-called clippers over to China huge consignments of opium, which they forced upon the Chinese people. And in fact, Britain fought two major wars against China to impose its will to be able to continue to sell opium to the Chinese people. And they turned China into a nation of opium addicts. And that's how this organization, the British East India Company, gained their huge revenues. They virtually controlled England from top to bottom. And of course, they exerted their influence to the United States as well. And when President Wilson came back from the disastrous Paris Peace Conference after the First World War, he was told to set up a branch office in the United States, which they called the Council on Foreign Relations. But the orders that we are given to our government to obey come down from London through the Royal Institute of International Affairs to the Morgan Guarantee and Trust Bank on Wall Street, and then to the various organizations of government. And to my dismay, I found out that the Committee of 300 was based exactly on the board membership of the old British East India Company. Quite a fascinating story, which took me to many different countries of the world, and places like Dubai, where all the banking is done, Macau, where all the gold is exchanged and refined into smaller bars, and to the far corners of the earth. So mine has been on a basis of personal experience and hands-on working with this project since 65.
Have you had...
That's not the only book I've written. I've written 23 books altogether. Several of my books are very popular in Japan, and this is quite unusual because the Japanese are not very partial to Western writers, but they seem to like my style and what I have to say. And I published recently also a book exposing the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations with its effect upon the United States economic and political policies and monetary policies. Then I've written also what you should know about the U.S. Constitution. I'm very much a keen buff of the Constitution. When I first came to the United States, I became a citizen and went to see the late Senator Sam Ervin, and I asked him how I could learn about the Constitution, because I thought every American knew exactly what the Constitution was about, and it was my duty to learn it. So he said to me, don't waste your time going to universities, they don't teach it. He said, the American people have been dumbed down. The Constitution is not wanted by the higher powers. And so he said, what you should do is study the annals of Congress, the congressional gloves and the congressional records. And he said, I'll help you, I'll get you as many copies of these as I can lay my hands on, and then it'll be a lifetime work for you. And to date, I've read and studied intensely 37,000 pages of these documents. And I've written a book called What You Should Know About the U.S. Constitution, and that book has proved to be very, very well received. And I'm going to update it this year and put the latest information in. Of course, it's an ongoing process. I'm still reading, and it's a lifetime work, as he told me. But it's really something that I have benefited very greatly by doing.
Let me ask you, when you were going to the equivalent of high school and university, for many of us over here in the United States, we kind of figured, especially those of us who grew up during Vietnam, going from high school to college, we always kind of knew, and it was hinted at, that something really wasn't right, that there was something that we weren't being given a clean bill of goods on. But you ignore that stuff. You're obviously very much propagandized by mainstream news. What I was wondering was, in your lifetime, was there especially, I mean, we're going to look at the seat of this in London and such, and we're talking about the Rhodes and Milner and all them. Did you grow up with that feeling, or perhaps the very palpable reality, that something is not exactly the way we're being told it is, and there is somebody definitely behind the curtain?
No, when I was growing up, when I was a young man in high school, in what the equivalent of high school in England, it's not called high school over there, but my high school days and my early days of college, I felt very happy to be in the Western Hemisphere. I thought the greatest governments in the world were the United States and Britain. I couldn't see anything better beyond that. It was only in later years when I began to travel around and my job took me all over the world that I began to get serious doubts about what my views were based upon. And one of the things that really set me off was I went, during the course of writing this book, Committee of 300, I went to South Africa, because one of the most important wars, this may sound strange to some people who don't know too much about it, one of the most important wars of the 20th century was the Anglo-Boer War in South Africa from 1899 to 1902. Because you had this small little pastoral country there with about a very tiny handful of people. They were called Boers because they were farmers. That's the Dutch word for farmers. And the Boers were actually a German, Dutch, French, and quite a lot of English people mixed in with them as well. And they had been given the right to secede from the British colony of the Cape, and they went thousands of miles into the hinterland, which were deserted. There were no black nations there, by the way. They came later from the wars north of the Zambezi River, and they set up two republics in the Transvaal and the Orange Free State. And these, the Queen's geologists had gone out of there, Queen Victoria. He was sent there to look at the place before they took it over to see if there was any raw material assets of any value. And I read his report in the British Museum in London. A huge term, and he concludes that I remember from practically verbatim that he said, and I conclude, Your Majesty, that there are no metals or valuable minerals of any kind, and there's nothing there of any worthwhile for exploitation. Well, a few years later, a drunken Australian prospector by the name of Pringle was stumbling about the hills, which today are covered by the metropolis of Johannesburg, and he stumbled upon the greatest gold strike the world has ever known. Beneath him, a river, literal river of gold, running for 200 miles north to south, east to west, from east to west. And thereupon, when that discovery was made, and they began mining the gold in huge quantities, Queen Victoria suddenly decided that they didn't have independence and that they needed to be taken back under the control of the Committee of 300. And Britain sent a mighty armada out to South Africa, 400,000 men, as many as we sent to Vietnam in 1899, to subdue this tiny little country, to take off their natural resources of gold. And yet this small little nation of people that were very God-fearing, and of their president, Paul Kruger, they staved off defeat by this mighty British army for 3 years, in which they inflicted grievous losses on the British forces. And eventually, the only way that the British could defeat them was to open up concentration camps. And they adopted a scorched earth policy. They burned down all the farms and homesteads and killed all the cattle, and they herded the women and children into rail cars and drove them out onto the high plateaus and put them in tents, where they kept them for the duration of the 3 years, and 27,000 of them died of disease and starvation and malnutrition and neglect. If you take it demographically, that would be about 16 million Americans by our standards. And by that way, the Boer soldiers were forced to give up and come in from the field, and the British gained control of the diamond fields with Cecil John Rhodes, and the gold and many of the other treasures, vast treasures that are found in South Africa, titanium, tantalite, many, many of these metals that are used in our aerospace and space industries today. And of course, the profits of that all went into the City of London banks, and the people of South Africa benefited nothing from it, or very little from it anyway. And that's been the progression through all lands, where they've come into possession of the raw materials that belong to the nations by subterfuge or by armed conflict, one way or the other. And we see that policy continue today in Iraq after the East. I don't think there's any doubt that we are really concerned about oil supplies for the United States. I believe that's our main concern at the moment.
Do you...
And,
I'm sorry, Doug, I was going to ask you...
You had a question?
Yeah, and it relates to the Boer War. I'm just wondering if it had even bigger reverberations than most people know, and so I'll just throw this out to you. Is it possible...
That was their first attempt to subdue a nation and rob it of its treasures, and they were only partially successful because of the spirit of the Boers. They never had more than 80,000 men in the field at any one time, and some of them, I've been to every one of the museums, war museums out there and battlefields, and it's really a very sobering experience. Some of these Boers, men in the Boer army were 14 years old, and some of them were 70 years old. And the most they ever had in the field was 80,000.
Well, some have written that the Boer War took, as you said, exacted a pretty high toll on the British Army.
It did.
Now, along with this also, is it possible, you know, as I seem to believe from what I've read, that that Britain and the British Empire turned towards the United States and its military, as some would say that Rhodes said to be the dumb beast to fight the war so that Britain's best blood could no longer do. Do you see, is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. We were sucked into the, take the First World War, for instance. The whole design of the First World War was drawn in up by England, and Wilson was given his marching orders and told to get the U.S. forces into the World War, raging in Flanders in France, and he actually broke the law violently by conscripting the militia to fight overseas. And there was one very, very fantastic patriotic American by the name of Hannes Taylor, a lawyer, who tried to impeach Wilson and did his best to stop this from happening. And he gave a most impassioned speech in the Congress, and won the congressional record, in which he charged Wilson with all types of malfeasance and dereliction of duty and downright treason, but it didn't stop. Taylor went to the editor of the New York Times and said, I want you to help me. I'm trying to get this terrible, grievous righted. And the man said to him, a decision has been taken in England for the United States to go into the war, and there's nothing that you or anybody else can do to stop it. That's all in the congressional record. But like the late Senator Sam Mervin told me, he said, John, my boy, the trouble is nobody reads these documents. Well, I've read 37,000 pages of them, intensely studied of them, and I can tell you they contain a mine, a priceless treasure, a mine of information. If you're willing to devote your time to doing that, which not too many people are, because, as he said, and I've said it twice already in this program, nobody reads those documents.
You know, I know that's an accurate statement. I only wish that, like Irvin or others who say such, that they would be the ones that would talk to their constituencies and tell them to do that. That somehow just never seems to happen, though, you know?
No, it doesn't.
Now, also, do we have to have the Lusitania as a triggering event to get Americans impassioned about jumping in?
Well, I prefer to call them contrived situations.
Okay.
That's my description of them. And the thinking of the Lusitania was, of course, a contrived situation. The ship was loaded with munitions bound for Britain. And under the rules of war, Geneva Convention, it then became an armed merchant cruiser by definition of the Geneva Convention, so it was fair game. And the Germans took a big, I think for 2 or 3 days, took a full-page ad out in the New York Times warning passengers who would travel on the ship not to travel on, because it would be a fair game. It was now an armed merchant cruiser, since it was carrying a massive shipment of arms destined for Britain. And even when it got into the Liverpool Roads, the entrance to the sea where they start going towards Liverpool, the Lusitania actually slowed down, and that's when it was torpedoed.
Can
of course, we have the case of Pearl Harbor. I think that's pretty well known.
Oh, of course.
It was a contrived situation.
Sure. One other thing, I don't know, I just came upon this recently, I don't know how valid it is. Can you confirm or deny or perhaps not know whether or not it is true that, as you said, the Lusitania not only slowed down, but did the British drop their cover for that ship, its protection?
No, I don't think they did that.
Okay.
That would have been too obvious, but they did. The captain had orders to slow down, which he was absolutely astounded by. He couldn't understand why he was in dangerous waters, he had to slow down, but that was, of course, the instructions passed on to him.
At this point, Dr. Coleman, why don't we talk about the website and the books that are available up there? This looks kind of new to me. I don't know if I'm accurate in stating that or not, but it's a good-looking site, and I'm glad that you've got those books up there. Would you speak to them?
Are you talking about my website?
Yes.
Oh, it's www.coleman300.com, and I have some of my books up there. I have the book Beyond the Conspiracy, which is a successor book to companion successor book to the Committee of 300 fourth edition. I have the Committee of 300 fourth edition, which is really the Bible for all conspiracy theorists. And I have the Tavistock Institute for Human Relations, which tells about the greatest propaganda organization the world has ever known. I think there's only one person that I know of who was beyond and above the Tavistock, and that was a German by the name of Willy Münzenberg. And this man was nothing but short of but brilliant, and he had exposed all of the United States and British secrets of the First and Second World War to the people he was working for. So that's the Tavistock Institute, which is a propaganda organization. And then my book, What You Should Know About the U.S. Constitution, which I briefly touched upon, and Diplomacy by Deception. This is a cataloging of events that have taken place involving the U.S. and British governments, which I think makes interesting reading because it really throws a searchlight on some of the events that have taken place, which people are a little bit of at a loss to understand. And I believe that after reading that book, they'll come to a better understanding of some of these events.
All right. If we
and
could,
of course, I've written over 500 white papers called monographs on a very wide variety of subjects in which I'm fairly well versed. There's about 100 different subjects I've covered, and a monograph is a treatise on a specialized subject, and these have been exceptionally well received by people I have amongst my readership, college professors, scientists, all sorts of people, as well as, God bless us, the ordinary Americans like myself. Not that I do so much reading of my own work, but at least I know what I'm writing about. And I have a series of audio tapes as well. We are going to convert all of these to CDs in the near future to make it perhaps more accessible to a lot of people.
Are you stating that there would be books on tape?
We will put them on tape.
Okay.
Of course, they'll be on CDs.
Okay. Right.
Now, that's still some way off. Right now, we only have them in the printed form.
And you also have the World in Review newsletter, do you know?
The World in Review is a news magazine that comes out every second month, and I cover all the political events and economic events. I cover events that are of interest in the U.S. and abroad, and I do economics, political science, and some history as well in that magazine. And if anybody wants to get a copy of the magazine at no charge or would like to receive a catalog from us, they could call us at 702-448-5532, and we'd be glad to send it to them.
Turning back to the Committee of 300, I'm going to ask you about three personages, if we could. One that I'm very fascinated by as it regards, I think, the propagandizing of the American people early on, I think coincidental also with the creation of the Council on Foreign Relations, someone that you've mentioned in your book, wrote somewhat extensively about, and that would be Edward Bernays. He is some kind of character, is he not, in the landscape of American history?
Edward Bernays was one of the mainstays when Britain wanted to go to war with Germany. And don't forget, Britain started the First World War and the Second World War. There's a false perception that the Germans were the aggressors. The Germans were not the aggressors. The British were. They were in the situation that led up to the First World War. They were very disturbed about the expansion of Germany, their trade, their burgeoning trade going into all the areas that were formerly completely covered by British trade, not only in Africa, but all along in Europe, even into some of the best areas of Europe that had had previously been the sole territory of the British, so they were becoming alarmed about this. And Lord Grey went to see King George V, and they had a secret conclave. And those papers are in the British Museum. You couldn't get access to them because they're in the special section that's close to the public. But Lord Grey discussed with King George the possibilities of going to war with Germany. And it was a very strange situation that developed. But trade, you see, all wars are economic in origin. That's something we have to understand, clearly. There's not a war that's been fought that has not had an economic reason for doing so. And they concluded the only way to stop the German trade was to make an excuse, a pretext, to have them fight a war. And that's exactly how the First World War came about. And I tell all of that in my book, The Tavistock Institute for Human Relations. I give a chapter and verse. But they needed, the British people at that time were violently against war with Germany. There were demonstrations, there were letters to the editors, people were complaining. They said, we know the Germans, they've never done us any harm, why should we go to war against them? And there was a big, big protest among the ordinary British people. So they gave the task to two British people to propagandize the ordinary British people into accepting the war, and they set up an institution in London, and that was where they churned out all of their propaganda from. And then they realized that they needed, in order to suck America into this war, they needed two people from America to come and slant the propaganda so it would be suitable to pass on to the American people as well. And they contacted Edward Bernays as one of them. And he came over there, and they set up this massive organization in which they literally churned out propaganda about Germany, which 90% of it was false. The gist of it was that the Germans were barbarians, and in their march to Belgium when the war started, they had this propaganda machine going that the Germans had cut off the arms of children and raped wholesale the women in the villages. And Upton Sinclair was an American icon. He said, I don't believe any of this. So he took a team of 15 lawyers. He went over to Europe in the midst of the heat of all the battle. He went, followed the German army through, and he offered a $10,000 reward to any woman who had come forward in this one village where they alleged the Germans had raped all the women in the village. If anyone would come forward and swear an affidavit that this had happened, or if any father or mother had lost a child through brutality, having their arms chopped off, would come forward, and not one of them came forward. And Upton Sinclair came back to the United States, and he declared very vociferously that this whole effort was a propaganda effort to try and get America sucked into World War I. Unfortunately, Wilson's voice was greater, and he actually welcomed the people from the propaganda mill in England. They came and did a tour, and some of them were even taken and entertained at the White House, and their stories were spread throughout the American newspapers. And of course, with that in mind, they were able to convince Americans who were very much against the war to change their minds. That's the Tavistock Institute, the greatest and the most evil propaganda institution the world has ever known.
Well, Bernays had been on the continent. Obviously, he had been consorting and consulting with his uncle, Sigmund Freud.
Oh, yeah, and he was a very great friend of Eleanor Roosevelt in later life.
Who would that be, Bernays?
Edward Bernays.
Okay, I mean, Bernays was, okay. Well, I mean, so it's not so much of a stretch to think if he was there anyway in Europe. Why?
The other guy was there, I forgot, I just temporarily couldn't remember his name, Walter Lippmann.
Lippmann, right.
Walter Lippmann and Edward Bernays were the duo that got America into the First World War.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I had said to you off mic, that when I confronted, and I didn't mean to do it in a confrontational manner, but I wanted Bernays' biographer, Larry Tye, to speak to it. And like I said, I can't say he was impolite, but he got very tight-lipped, and I felt that there was a certain distance then, and let's just get this interview over with. I also have read the two
two books. I think both titles you mentioned in Committee of 300, and that is Crystallizing Public Opinion and Propaganda.
Right. That's in my book, too.
Well,
tell a story about that.
I mean, I went there because of reading it in your book, and honestly, folks ought to really read both to find out exactly what, quote, they think about us, so lovingly calling us the group and the herd.
George Bertrand Russell, their chief spokesman, called most of us as useless eaters. He said we should be culled. He said wars hitherto have been unsuccessful and not killed enough people.
Well,
so we need to reintroduce things like the Black Plague and get rid of these people. He said there are far too many people on the earth and they're consuming the natural resources that belong to the Olympians, the Committee of 300.
But
they're senior statesmen.
Well, first I want to ask you one thing before I go to another. We're going to drift away from it. In the university library for which I once worked, there were two volumes there, which looked pretty good to me. I read as much as I could. The two volumes were Lord Grey, his letters to Wilson, and, of course, mostly House. Are you familiar with those two volumes at all?
Oh, yes. I studied them. I had access to them at Oxford.
That's what I thought. Okay.
But they gave me special access to the papers. The family were very good to me. They gave me access to the papers of Lord Grey. I was able to read up a lot of that material, and I incorporated it in my book, Tavistock Institute. It's very much rather clearly laid out in that book.
I don't think that university realizes what it has there in those two volumes.
Well, it's extremely valuable.
Yes.
Lord Grey was really the instigator of the
film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can see that story as you read the volumes. You can see this kind of... perhaps this is not the best word for it, but this seduction, more or less, or this courting of Wilson to get him involved through House, and House seems to be the one who's more interested in this kind of thing.
Right. Well, of course, you know Colonel House, Mendel House, was Wilson's controller.
Yes.
And he was hand in glove with all of these people in England. He went to England and before war was declared, and he said, even just before he set sail on one of his big ships there at the time, he told one of the newspapers that there will be war and America will be involved in it. And nobody believed him. They thought he was joking.
Well, let me ask you, do you have any opinion on what got Wilson in the White House? Teddy Roosevelt comes out of mothballs, can only siphon votes away from Taft. Was this a manipulation of the American voters to get Wilson into the presidency? And if so, did he show himself as being more willing or more malleable to work with the elites?
What Wilson was an internationalist, an ardent socialist.
Okay.
And what is socialism? Socialism is a member of the family of communism.
Communism, yeah.
Communism is merely socialism in a hurry. And that Wilson was a very ardent socialist, so he was very easy to manipulate. And Roosevelt was of another stripe altogether. He was gung-ho and quite of another stripe, not so easy to manage. And Wilson was the chosen vessel. That's why he got elected.
Well, with Teddy coming back in, that definitely, what I would think, through the election toward Wilson.
Well, that's of course what they always do. We've seen it recently with Ross Perot and other people like that coming in. And that's a fairly good common tactic.
Yeah, and what's even more interesting about Perot is that he gets into the race, leaves the race, and comes back in again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can see the hand of these people behind everything if you look hard enough for it.
Now, you can't miss the fact that many of these dynamic figures in the committee, in what we would call the elites, some call the Illuminati, are...
Well, the Illuminati is just a branch of the whole apparatus. It's a separate thing founded by Weishaupt,
right.
1659, somewhere around there. But that's another order. There's so many. If you look at my book, I list them all, and that's one of them. But it's not, as many people imagine, the most important one at all.
So you would not necessarily use that term as the umbrella term for the elites?
No, I wouldn't do that.
Okay. But going back to so many of the shakers and movers come out of England Even when you read George Bernard Shaw with the Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism,
yeah,
and the statement he makes in his epilogue where it says, you know, if you don't want to be forcibly fed and clothed and housed and given a job, you could be executed in a kindly manner. And you look at that and you go, is this guy kidding? And this is the playwright, George Bernard Shaw.
They were not kidding.
No, they weren't. What is going on with that crew at that time?
Well, that were determined to spread. Beatrice and Sidney Webb.
Right.
And one of the very rich people that financed them was a railroad magnate in England by the name of Potter. And Harry Potter's stories were all written by that man. The lady who claims to be the author is not the author at all. She was just given the job of editing and given a nice little title. But the stories written by Potter were written by the old man Potter, who was the beneficiary of Sidney and Beatrice Webb, who began the Fabian Socialist movement,
right,
in England. And they really intended to socialize the world, but began in a very small way. Potter was a very rich railroad magnate, helped them with a lot of money. And they sent one of their emissaries to the United States in 1895, and he toured the United States and came back and said that this United States will never be socialized unless and until we can get rid of this. And interesting the juxtaposition, he said, until we can get rid of this state and federal constitution, we'll never be able to socialize the United States. That was Ramsay MacDonald, who became a future Prime Minister of England. And the Webb, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, connected all kinds of people. H.G. Wells, some of the greatest minds of the time in England came to their chambers and then joined them in their ardent desire to turn the world into a socialist paradise.
How much validity would you impute toward Carol Quigley's work?
I'm sorry?
How much validity would you impute to Carol Quigley's work? Because he also has focused on that same crew in his books, The Anglo-American Establishment, and to a certain extent, in Tragedy and Hope.
I've only read Tragedy and Hope. I don't know if he's written anything else. I've read that years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't talk about the Committee of 300, but
no,
to my knowledge.
No, and let me ask you one other thing, too. Despite what's been done on Rhodes, the Round Table, known as Kindergarten, there's another society. Have you ever come across it that nobody really seems to talk about? And it's as old as the Round Table, and that is the Pilgrim Society.
Oh, the Pilgrims. I talk about them extensively in my book. And the Pilgrim Society and the London Missionary Society in South Africa are one and the same thing. They sent these people out there to soak up the blacks, to cause trouble against the Boer Republics. And in China, they were busy doing the work of the opium people. And I tell you what, it's a very interesting story. But there are many, many of these. The London Missionary Society in South Africa was pretty active. And I do believe the other people, and this was called the China Inland Mission, they were used extensively too.
Now, it just seems that while something to a certain extent was given away about Milner and Rhodes.
Well, you know that Cecil John Rhodes, I was able to access his papers at Oxford, the Rhodes Scholarship papers, and I went to all of the museums that house his artifacts in South Africa, some of his clothing and some of his the desk he used and some of his speeches in the Cape Parliament. And he was supposed to be siding with the blacks. They wanted the vote, he said. Yet in the Cape Parliament, he said, as long as I'm a member of this parliament, no black will ever get the vote. Now, those papers have never been published. Those are found in a museum in Cape Town, South Africa. I don't know if they're still there today, but they were when I went out and looked at them. But Rhodes was a protege. Excuse me. Excuse me, I didn't mean that to happen.
That's okay.
And Rhodes went. I was able to go to Rhodes in the Rhodes people in England in Oxford too and study the details there. And he was, of course, the Rothschild agent. And I detail that very much in my book, The Rothschild Dynasty, which is also up on our website, I believe.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
I give the full story of Rhodes and the Rothschild dynasty.
One other individual I don't know. I don't think you put him in Tavistock. I'm just wondering if you've come across anything, and let me just ask you. George Orwell, Eric Blair.
Oh, George Orwell, I've written quite extensively. George Orwell was an MI6 operative, a very, very shrewd operator, and he had a lot of insights and information that's not available to most people. In his book, 1984, a lot of people think he was talking about the Soviet Union. He was talking about Britain and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
He was not talking about Russia. Anybody who gets that idea can disavow it straight away. He did not have Russia in mind. He was directing his remarks specifically to Britain and the United States.
We know that he wrote, I guess you could say, propaganda for the BBC during World War II. But do you know if he had any involvement with Tavistock?
No. No, oh. He didn't.
All right, then let me...
He would not lend himself to that kind of activity at all.
I've done a series on him, reading excerpts of a book by Ian Slater called Orwell, The Road to Airstrip 1. I think it's a pretty decent book, and the thing I've been asking the audience to contemplate, and I'll put the question to you. I look at 1984, and I look at the changes that he went through post-Spanish Civil War. It's my feeling that he was warning us of the things to come. How do you feel about that?
Oh, I'm absolutely sure he was.
I mean, he wasn't...
He had great insight. This was a man bordering on genius. And not only that, he had access to lots of documents that normal people would never see. And plans that were made for all kinds of future events. Don't forget, the Committee of 300 doesn't plan for today. They plan 50, 60, 70
right.
years ahead.
Mm-hmm. Another... individual.
The only one that stood in their way was Stalin. If it hadn't been for Stalin, their world conquest would have been probably complete by now. And that may sound strange to you. Yes, Stalin was not very much loved by anybody, including me. But he said he was not going to be taken in by what he called a bunch of cosmopolitans. But first he deceived America into believing he was on their side, and then when he'd gained all the secrets of the atom bomb, he turned around and said to them, now you can all go to hell.
So in other words...
The Korean War was really to contain Stalin. That was the whole idea behind it.
So Stalin was a rogue?
He was what?
He was a rogue?
No, I don't think so. Stalin was, of course, not a very good person. He was certainly a mass murderer, to put it no higher than that. But he stood up for Russia. And you have to admire the way he galvanized Russia, even went to the Russian Orthodox Church and said, help us. Our motherland is being invaded. That's when Germany invaded Russia. They talked Hitler into attacking Russia, which he fell for.
Mm-hmm.
And he got all the Russian people behind him, and he was able to defeat the German army and drive them out. And so... My point about Stalin is that he stood in the way of the Committee of 300. He wouldn't bow to their dictates. He wouldn't take part in any of their schemes. And once he was suitably armed, and he said, well, now that's it. We're not going to have any part of your new world order. And I think the presidents they have now, President Putin, is continuing in the same vein.
When I met Rogue, I thought that he was in tow also to the committee, and you're stating he's not. Do you believe that he was, in fact, assassinated, poisoned?
Stalin?
Yes.
Oh, sure. It's called the doctor's plot. Four doctors got hold of him
mm-hmm.
and injected him with poison when he was sick. They were so scared of him, they weren't even sure when he died that he was dead, and they left him for several days.
That's right, in the room.
Oh, yeah.
That's
absolutely factual.
Was Khrushchev marginally involved with that crew?
Probably.
Yeah, I think he was. Okay.
Might be, because Khrushchev was the first of that of the old Bolsheviks to come back into government. So.
Right.
Stalin got rid of them all. You know, the Bolsheviks, he wiped them all out, including Leon Trotsky, that he followed all the way to Mexico.
Mexico, yeah.
Had him stabbed in the head with an ice pick. So Stalin got rid of the Bolsheviks. He didn't want to have anything to do with them. And he said that many of their origins could be traced back to the United States, which is perfectly
true. That's true, that's right.
We know Trotsky was on the east side of New York,
mm-hmm.
sedition, and... We know that he got an American passport and was allowed to travel on the ship to Europe, and when the Canadian authorities boarded a ship in Nova Scotia because he was wanted on an international bank warrant robbery charge, and arrested him. They got a phone call from Wilson saying, let this guy go, he's one of ours.
Mm-hmm. By the way, what did Stalin consider himself?
I'm sorry?
What did Stalin consider himself? If not a Bolshevik, he was...
He was not... Stalin wanted communism for Russia. He did not want... He did not want what I would call advanced socialism, i.e. communism, mm-hmm. or any other country in the world. He said, this is purely for Russia. I don't want this to be a worldwide movement. And Trotsky was, of course, one for spreading it out throughout the world. That's where they parted in the ways.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the things that were blamed on Stalin historically were not to be laid at his door. I don't want to get too far away from
right.
the subject of the book, because then we can really get into the highways and the byways. My book, The Committee of 300, is considered as the Bible for all people who are interested in conspiracies, because I've really delved into the thing over many, many years, and traveled to 14 different countries and investigated hands-on, on-site, before writing this book. And one of the things you talked to me about the other day was the Beatles. Well, the Beatles were the creation of the Tavistock Institute. And you know, you have to go back to your college days on the writings of Aristotle. And I made a note this morning before I came on this program of what he said about music and its influence on politics. He said, emotions of any kind are produced by melody and rhythm. Therefore, by music, a man becomes accustomed to feeling the right emotions. Music has the power to form character, and the various kinds of music based on the various modes may be distinguished by their effect on character. For one example, working in the direction of melancholy, another in the direction of effeminacy, one encouragement, abandonment, another self-control, another enthusiasm, and so on through the series. And what I discovered was that the actual Tavistock Institute took this up, this theme. And they said, we are going to put this into practice. And well before Theo Adorno, who was the creator of the Beatles, arrived in England, he was already well known to Tavistock. And he was offered a facility at Scotland's at Gordonson School, where the royalty were educated. And as soon as he landed in, he had to flee Germany because he was tinkering with the minds of children through music. And he was known as the Karl Marx of music, and his theoretical music of composing music was adapted from another musical radical, a guy called Alban Berg, who had challenged the tonality of contemporary traditional music sounds. And Adorno claimed he was on a higher awareness, where every music work he composed, he said, was likely to be difficult to understand and shock people. And he called his sound, I think he said, was corrosive and unacceptable. And he adapted it from a strange music that was produced by a cult called the Cult of Dionysus. And they had devised a 12-8 tonal system, which was a new form of sound. And he said this sound was corrosive unacceptability to what he called the commercially defined sensibilities of the middle class. And his own words, he said that his music was Stalinist, I think he said old-fashioned. And he said, this is what I'm going to try and do. And then he started writing all these songs and these things in the 12 eternal system. How he got hold of the Beatles, I'm not too sure about that. But I did go over to Germany, and I found out where these people had been operating. And to understand the Beatle music, one has to understand why Adorno championed new music, as he called it. And it really sprang from his belief that the what he called the bourgeoisie did not want music that makes demands on the senses. They wanted easy things to listen to, nothing that would bother them or make them think. And of course, the Tavistock New Science scientists said that's exactly what they needed. They needed this new music that they could kick around like a football and then pass on to mass audiences, which would involve themselves in this new musical experience, a sort of fundamental revolution that would affect millions of the masses who are generally known to have only a very shallow experience in music. And thus was born a whole set of uncomfortable music, as he called it, Adorno's term, based on the 12 atonal system. And that he composed especially for the Beatles. And people wonder why they were called the beetles. Well, he took this from the scarab beetle, which is an ancient Egyptian symbol. And the scarab beetle, was what inspired them to call the Tavistock New Science Scientists to call them, this group, the beetles. It wasn't just a name chosen out of the future. Mm-hmm. And he also worked on voodoo drumming, which was quite a complex subject. He said it's not simple, but consists of complex patterns that affect the mind. And of course, the beetle music didn't come anywhere near close to achieving such a state when it was first introduced, but it regressed, and as we know, later groups came out of England, all out from the same stable, and their music became absolutely brutal. I mean, rock music today is brutal. It brutalized the mind and desensitizes the sensitive. There's a continuous broken meteor played over a repetitive beat with the left hand and increasing in tempo, and then, of course, it's been proved over and over to have a hysterical effect on the mind and the body and on the whole body organs. And that's precisely what Tavistock wanted to happen. But they did it just a little bit at a time. They brought the Beatles in and gave a gradual introduction as to what was to follow. And now we have some of the worst stuff come out of England.
Well,
Jagger, the Rolling Stones, and even worse.
I'm just wondering whether that brutality, which I would affix almost nearly completely today to rap music, after going through
rap music re-evolved from rock and roll music,
right? But I think there definitely is.
Of course, what they wanted was they used the Beatles as for proliferation of the drug usage amongst American youth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the cover words in the song, the Beatles song, was Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, that stands for LSD. And the yellow submarine was signified a particular type of get-high drug. It was like a yellow submarine in shape. And these were all code words which became very well known to the teenagers at the time.
Well, then let me ask you, because, I mean, John Lennon has denied LSD meant that. But that's another thing. What I'm curious about, too, is if the Beatles were a construct of Tavistock, they obviously knew things, and I'm just wondering, if Lennon is assassinated, which I think he was, I think that's an MKUltra classic hit, was he about to say something? I mean, was he about to give it away?
Yeah, he was.
Ah.
He was about to blow the whistle. That's exactly...
That is true.
It got absolutely sick of the whole thing. And he was about to blow the whistle.
Do you agree that is a Manchurian candidate set up?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Beatles, you understand, they're part of they're an integral part of the Aquarian conspiracy, which sprang from a paper done at Stanford University under the aegis of Tavistock called The Changing Images of Man. And the Beatles, and it's not a spontaneous rebellion by youth against old social systems. It was a carefully crafted plot by Tavistock, which, of course, they were careful not to identify themselves, to introduce a highly destructive and divisive element into a large population group targeted for changes against its will. And new words and phrases were prepared by Tavistock, and social scientists were introduced to America along with new music, such as rock and teenager and cool and discovered and pop music. And these were a lexicon of disguised code words, sickness, and signifying the acceptance of drugs. Codex was inserted into the Beatles songs, as I've told you, Lucy in the Sky, Diamonds, and so on and so forth. And the word teenager, by the way, is unknown just before the Beatles arrived on the world stage. Never been heard before. All these were created, along with the music, they created a whole lexicon of new terms as well.
Can I ask you, though, I wonder what George Martin's role was in all this, and you may not know, but was he the acceptable personage out there who could...
I don't know.
Yeah, that's a tough one. All right. Also, I want to run something by you. I had told you that I got in touch with a researcher who has done work in Adorno. He clearly is just not a usual composer. He's very much involved with, I think, the psychology and sociology of music.
Of course.
Now, I'm just going to throw a line out from another researcher, not the one that I wanted to speak to, but somebody to which this individual referred someone else. I'm going to just ask you about this line. This is kind of cryptic,
We may not have the time to go into it, but let me just do it since you're here, Doctor. And that is, specifically, I'm wondering whether Adorno or others in the Frankfurter School, I guess that is, ever articulated a free speech theory in these terms, possibly in the specific context of an anti-fascist program.
Not of an anti-fascist program, no. They didn't.
Was Adorno chased out of Germany because he was an anti-fascist?
Adorno was chased out of Germany because he was tinkering with children's minds.
Okay.
Through music. And he was promoting socialism, which was a very taboo subject for Germany. Being close to communism, the Germans equated socialism with communism. That's why he was chased out of Germany. He was actually tinkering with the minds of children through music. I got onto him pretty quickly, and he was chased out of Germany, and he was given sanctuary by the British royal family, and he was put up at Gordonston School, which, as you probably know, was where Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, and Prince Charles, and all the British white fellows get educated.
As Tavistock was to the British, what we call the British Second Invasion with music.
Oh, absolutely. They were behind it every inch of the way. And Ed Sullivan was instructed to go out and gather as many teenagers, preponderance of girls if possible, young girls. They were paid $20 each and bussed out to the airport in New York. And they started swooning and crying and going mad when the Beatles, they'd never even heard the Beatles' music, not been played in America.
Yep. Last question, and as Tavistock was to the invasion by the Brits, what about Stanford Research Institute, perhaps?
That's part of it.
And rock and roll here.
Stanford is under control of Tavistock.
Right.
And I name all these institutions that are controlled by Tavistock in the United States, and it's a pretty formidable list. And I would recommend that if anybody really wants to know more about the subject, not because I've written a book, but it's the only book I know of that really lists all these organizations. That's the fourth edition of my book, The Committee of 300. If anybody would like to order a copy of it, they can go to the website, www.coleman300.com, or they can call us at 702-448-5532, and we'll gladly service their needs.
Well, those three titles especially that we've talked about to some extent, and that is the fourth edition of the committee.
Yes.
Also the Rothschild Dynasty and the Tavistock Institute.
Right. And the Tavistock, it's really a threesome of books that should really be read in tandem with each other.
Yeah, and folks, like I said, you know, they're very well aware of what you've done, and with this fourth edition, we're looking forward to it. And listen, I thank you for being with us. It's good to hear you. It's good to hear you hale and hearty, and I hope somewhere down the road we might be able to do this again. But
I'm sure that'll be possible, and thank you for the opportunity, Keith.
All right, Dr. Coleman, God bless you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
This program is produced by Visigoth Incorporated. Any rebroadcast or use of this program without the express consent of Visigoth Incorporated is strictly encouraged. I'm Phil McCracken, the voice behind the voice, and thank you for listening.